You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're going to take a look at what happened in the recently concluded Illinois legislative session. A couple weeks ago, I had a guest on that looked what happened across the river in Iowa. And of course, as our listeners know, usually it's the mirror opposite of what's going on policy-wise between Iowa, which is, of course, is a controlled by the Republicans, and Illinois, which is controlled by the Democrats. Here to do that with me is Patrick Fingston. I've had Patrick on as a guest before. He operates, writes, does everything, publishes the Illinois online newsletter. What I like about it is it's independent, objective. It's old-fashioned reporting and analysis and opinion, and I think you'll like it if you're looking for something like that. I know I am, and so I strongly encourage you to check it out. Patrick, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you, Robin, and I think it's important to note that Illinois is a complicated state that stretches essentially from, you know, the north of the state is on the same line of Boston. The south of the state is on the same line as Richmond, Virginia, and Iowa has a bunch of corn. So it's a lot harder to do it here.
What I also like about you is your downstate roots. That's important. Illinois wrapped up. The Democrats have what's called a trifecta. They control the Senate, the House, the governor. They've got veto-proof majorities in both houses. Everything went smoothly passing this budget, I assume, right?
You're a funny one, Robin. You're a funny one. It was anything but smooth sailing. So they had a deadline of the 24th, which is a self-imposed deadline. The constitutional deadline is May 31st before it requires a supermajority. But in essence, because you have supermajorities anyway, the deadline was really June 30th. So they blew past their own self-imposed deadline, which was to get home before Memorial Day and be able to go to parades and barbecues, et cetera, et cetera. And they weren't able to make a deal ahead of time because there was a lot of pushback inside Democratic caucuses. The House Democrats specifically, you have three real tents inside that Republican or that Democratic caucus in the Illinois House, where you have your uber progressives who want more taxes, more spending, investment, as they call it, in whatever they can get to expand government to do more for people as they see it. There's the governing wing, which is the let's do the best that we can with what we have. Let's keep our state on the right track. Let's kind of be old school Democrats here. And then you have the moderates, which are, you know, maybe I don't think it's quite 20 votes, but it's definitely, you know, in that 10 probably range. And you saw a few sparse, you know, differences here and there on the roll calls of people who want to address the state budget, state government as a whole, a little less progressively and maybe a little bit, you know, maybe investigate cuts more before we're increasing taxes, maybe roll back some of these big spending programs, maybe not add new programs. And they've kind of been shouted down a little bit until this last week of the legislative session where essentially you needed moderates to come in and save the rest of Democrats literally in the middle of the night.
Interesting. I'm curious. I mean, for our listeners, Patrick's got a really diverse background in Illinois politics and government. He's worked as a journalist. He's worked on staff in Springfield. He's worked in government. He's worked as a political strategist. And now you're back into journalism. But isn't it typical for a legislature, like in an election year especially, to try to spend a lot of money to get votes, to please constituents heading into election? Or with Democratic control, does that matter as much? Did you see much evidence of that?
Well, typically you'll see some election year gimmicks. I mean, 2 years ago, you'll remember that they froze the gas tax and froze the sales tax and threw some extra money in some tax credit programs to try and show people what they've been willing, you know, what we're doing for you, you know, right? What does government do for you? And the main, and maybe it's just an old Madigan holdover, but you know, the rule in Springfield has always been not to raise taxes in an election year. You know, never raise taxes, not on business, not on sales tax, not, and certainly not individual taxes, minus the graduated income tax increase that they tried to do via referendum a few years ago that got whacked in a year that, you know, Joe Biden won the state by more than a million votes. That progressive tax idea went down in flames. So it was really the kind of opposite of what you typically see from Democrats in an election year of there weren't a ton of new programs. There were a few little things like eliminating the grocery tax, like an increased child tax care credit or a child tax credit for lower income families. But that's not an across the board go buy a vote sort of program. And then there were the tax increases on business that of course have been the huge speculation the huge discussion over the last couple of weeks. So it's really interesting to see that they kind of abandoned the norms in this whole budget process.
One issue that had a lot of mayors I know up in arms early on was the governor proposing to eliminate the grocery tax, the food tax. I mean, it sounds like a great idea. However, you know, for cities dependent on that revenues, it creates some problems. How did that all work out in the end?
Well, so essentially, the grocery tax is a small percentage of what's actually on your receipt, right? I mean, it's 1% of a certain number of things that can be taxed. Yeah, I actually went to the grocery store the other day and meant to keep my receipt to see what the grocery tax rate was, and I forgot to because I'm a dope, but the real loser here was local governments, because the grocery tax does not fund state government operations in any sense. It goes straight back to local governments. So you know, your Galena or your Rosemont all get those back. And the elimination of the grocery tax, which this was the political ploy that the governor made early in the year where he turned Republicans around so badly on the issue that it made it look like they opposed a tax increase or tax cut, which was slightly funny in terms of the typical political parlor games that people like you and I play. But there was a real consequence to it. I mean, we're talking millions and millions of dollars to downstate communities like Champaign and Peoria and in the Quad Cities, and obviously those in the suburbs and the city as well. We're looking at big holes. The governor's office essentially said, all right, well, we'll give you the opportunity to put a tax, a grocery tax of your own in place. So we're going to cut a grocery tax just so a city council can put it in on their own, and the city council can look like jerks for it instead of the governor. It clearly doesn't play very well. But if some of these cities don't increase their grocery tax or institute a new grocery tax, you're looking at a property tax increase. So it's you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And it's not particularly great public policy when the governor is doing this to say, I'm going to help people. But if a city doesn't have the political will, if you want to put it that way, to institute a new grocery tax, it's coming back to taxpayers one way or another. And Republicans totally blew the messaging on this. I mean, instead of, oh, don't hurt local governments, don't get rid of this tax, which they've all over the years have said, we don't like this tax. come out and say eliminate the grocery tax and fully fund the local government distributive fund, which Democrats have not been fully funding for decades. And they would have had a solution there, that it would have been, you would have been paying Peter and paying Paul. So it's part of the short-sightedness of government that I think makes a lot of us that are sort of center right like me, center, you know, left like others, just want to bang our heads against the wall and say, why are we playing these games?
It just seems like, and I'm partial to local governments because I used to be a local official, but it just seems like local governments are thrown under the bus constantly. And this was another example of that. Now, I do think, wasn't the implementation of this delayed? Because I know a lot of cities have their elections next spring. You know, there's a nice thing where you got to raise this tax right before an election, or was it the implementation at least delayed past the election?
Yeah, I'd have to go back and double check, but I think it's 2026.
Yeah. The other, I saw some other taxes raised on gaming. So are they kind of targeting that now as an easy target, an easy place to raise some more money, as opposed to raising taxes on people, income taxes?
Well, as you know, sports betting in the state is still in its infancy, but has exploded. I mean, I've got a sports betting app on my phone that I throw a few bucks on the Super Bowl or on the NCAA tournament. I mean, it's something a lot of folks do for fun. The sports betting companies, your FanDuel, your DraftKings, which you've probably seen the TV ads for, Rivers, Bet Rivers is one that's big, specifically in the suburbs, that they were charged 15%. Essentially a tax on all of their sports bets. The proposal was to increase that from 15% to 35%. It's not a tax paid by the people who make the bets, but it's paid for by the casino or by the betting service. You can argue that that may mean lower odds. It may mean, people go to offshore, back to the offshore gaming that gives you better odds. I don't know the answer to that. I'm clearly not smart about that. It's like, for me, it's like, are the Bears going to win today? No. All right, let's bet against them. That's my understanding of it, basically. So the sports betting companies, of course, put on a full court press because they don't want to pay more money. Of course they don't. They're a business. What business wants to pay more money? The governor's staff, who has been very bullying over the last few weeks of people in their own party, of business, of others. One of the governor's top spokespeople, when the sports betting company said, if you guys screw us, we're going to think about leaving the state. One of the governor's top spokespeople basically said, see ya. We all know it was an empty threat, but why be that? Why be that combative? Essentially, they worked out a deal that they graduate the tax on sports gaming, which is a little more similar to like the casino games and how they tax that, which is all on a ladder. I don't have all of those details committed to memory, Robin. If I did, I would be way smarter than I am. But the it graduates somewhere from 15 to 35% and will bring in essentially around $200 million next year.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm Robin Johnson, and My guest today is Patrick Fingston, and we're talking about the recently concluded Illinois legislative session, some of the highlights. Patrick is writes for the Illinois, ILLINOIZE, if you want to look it up. It's an independent, objective news and commentary source on Illinois politics, which is all you know is needed these days because of the closure of so many community newspapers. And we really need lots of diverse voices in our politics, and Patrick offers that. You mentioned football, and I've got to bring up, as a Bears fan, I'm sure a lot of folks saw this, where some sports owners came to Springfield with their hands out for new stadiums, the White Sox and the Bears. Didn't get very far. But usually they don't, especially in an election year. Do you think this is going to come up again? And what are the odds of this going through with some type of state subsidies?
Well, let's not just say it didn't go very far. It went nowhere, and it went nowhere fast. So the day the Bears held their news conference, it was a Wednesday in April, the governor and the speaker were doing a press conference at a suburban hospital, literally at the same time. I was standing in the back of the room with the Bears press conference playing on my phone in my ear and watching the press conference happen so that I could talk to the governor and the speaker at the same time. The speaker essentially shut the door. The governor said, I don't think there's an appetite for that. The speaker shut the door. Like, if you bring this to the House today, it's going to fail, and it's going to fail big. And nobody changed their position on that throughout the legislative session. Here's the real issue, I think, for the Bears. The stadium would be paid for, and the state is still paying, by the way, the renovation that was done when I was in high school, in the early 2000s we still owe something to the tune of like $600 million on that. And that might be totaled with a little bit of what's left for White Sox renovations. It's a lot of money that's still on the books. But there is a funding source for it. There's a hotel tax in the city of Chicago that funds sports facilities. The Bears want to refinance that $600 million, where I don't know if they think they can get a lower rate. I'm not sure how bond rates on things like that fall when interest rates for those of us who want to buy a house are through the roof, but their intention would be to refinance that, then issue new bonds totaling about $900 million to help build the stadium. That in theory isn't the worst idea in the world, because you already have a funding source. You're not raising taxes. It adds more debt, of course, which people can have their druthers about. The real issue here is that the Bears want the state to pick up a tab of $1.5 billion for infrastructure in and around that site on the lakefront. And Robin, you're a Bears fan. I hate going to Soldier Field. It is such a pain in the rear end to get down there, and that's not going to get any better. Even if we're talking about a new interchange on Lakeshore Drive, you know, they'd have to tear down the old Soldier Field. It's a really expensive proposition, and there's probably going to be even less parking. It's a real boondoggle. And Brandon Johnson, of course, the hapless mayor of the city of Chicago, throws his hands up in the air and says, I love it, because he doesn't have to pay anything. Because the Bears in the city are asking the state to pick up the entire bill. And that's, you're just not going to get that from the legislature in the way that it's currently constructed. And, you know, there's no real direct vote thing. It's not like the Kansas City Chiefs, who had a direct vote to reject a stadium plan there. There's no real mechanism for that in Illinois, but boy, is it going to be a really hard ask to get taxpayers to pick up the tab for Chicago Bears stadium infrastructure that they make $0 on in the long run.
My response would have been, win a Super Bowl and come back and we'll talk.
Hosting a Super Bowl would do more for the city than the Bears winning the Super Bowl, really. I mean, yeah. And I say that as a Cubs fan who literally cried when the Cubs won the World Series. So I know that it would mean a lot to win, but economically, hosting a Super Bowl in a domed stadium, imagine the look of, you're hosting the Super Bowl on a cool February night, and you've got the blimp flying over the lakefront with the lights and the stadium. It would be gorgeous. It would be the best tourism tool that the state could ask for, but you have to pay for it. And that's the real trick there.
That's a Chicago project that may or may not be in the future. And of course, as everyone knows, Chicago really does dominate the Chicagoland area, or dominates our state government. Is there anything in the budget, anything going on that should excite downstaters, the Quad City region, but anywhere around the state? I know that the Belvedere Auto Plant's going to be opening up near Rockford. I know they put some more money into Rivian, the electric vehicle maker down in Normal. Anything else generally that downstate should feel good about after this budget was passed?
You know, I think that education funding is something that I think they talk about in the abstract, but we're talking billions of dollars that goes into schools in this state. And they added another $350 million this year. So there's, you know, schools are being funded better than they have probably at any point. You're a little older than me, so definitely in my lifetime, but maybe in both of our lifetimes. Is that an effective, you know, is that effective, or test scores showing that? I don't know. You know, there continue to be significant capital projects that are funded through the capital bill that was passed 5 or so years ago now that are continuing to leak out. But in terms of like pet projects, you know, the Quad Cities will get some because they have Democratic legislators. If you live in a Republican district, you're not going to get anything. And that's one of the truly shady things the Democrats pulled in this budget was, if you're a Democratic member of the House, you get $1.5 million to spend on essentially whatever you want in your district. If you're a Democratic member of the Senate, you get $3 million to spend on essentially whatever you want in the district. If you're a Republican, you get zero. Even if you voted for the budget, which none of them did in the end, but zero. So why does Tony McCombie's district along the river that goes almost to Rockford, why do the communities in her district deserve zero when Greg Johnson's district in the Quad Cities deserves $1.5 million? Or Mike Halpin / Andrew Chesney, you know, it's just a political BS game that is bad for communities and bad for taxpayers, and instead is buying the votes of members of their own caucus and saying, congratulations, you're a Democrat and you're here. Here's some money to do with whatever you want. That's one of the things that just really bothers me about the entire way Springfield operates.
I'd have to agree. But
hey, you might get a street out of the deal.
Yeah. I do want to hit on politics here. There was a lot more that happened, but we won't get to it today in the legislature, but all this sets the table for the coming election in the fall. You know, Biden's going to win over Trump. Illinois is a blue state. We pretty much know that. My question is this. Do the Republicans have much hope for cutting into the Democratic margins, maybe to at least, you know, taking control of a House is for one cycle is almost impossible, but cut down the numbers enough to be competitive where it at least not have super majorities? Is that possible, Patrick?
Remind me to come back to Congress here on this, because that's the actual real question in your neck of the woods. Legislatively, no, it's a really bad situation for legislative Republicans. The way the Democrats gerrymandered the map in 2021 really put Republicans in a bad spot. Coming into this November's election, Republicans are defending 7 seats that Joe Biden won in 2020. There are another 2 seats that Donald Trump won by less than 2 points that Republicans are defending. So that's essentially, depending on what kind of wave, if you want to call it a wave, or what kind of, you know, what kind of mood you have in the electorate, that's as many as 9 seats that Republicans could lose. They're already at 40. I mean, it's already 78-40 in the House, and they could lose seats in November. There are a couple of pickup opportunities in the suburbs, maybe, you know, one or two downstate, but it's a really tough environment for Republicans in the House, especially when they're being flooded with millions of union dollars that are funding Democratic campaigns that Republicans don't have. And of course, the governor will probably put in a couple of million bucks of his own money that he found in his couch cushions at his vacation home in the Bahamas, that he'll throw into those races as well, that will just continue to snow over Republicans who are just in such a terrible spot. And it's hard because, you know, there aren't swing districts anymore. That's one of the downsides of the gerrymandered map is they're the only Democrat that's in play in November is Katie Stewart from the Metro East area. And that's actually a whole nother issue if we really wanted to get into it with the slating bill that got passed in 48 hours and Republicans snuck in trying to get a candidate against her in November and the judges put it on hold. So you've got more, et cetera. But that Stewart district, I think Biden won by 8 points. So it's still an uphill climb for Republicans, even in a place like the Metro East, where Donald Trump's going to do a hell of a lot better than he's going to do in the suburbs. So, and in the Senate, there are literally zero competitive races on either side this year. And that, you know, maybe you get a race like Mike Hastings in the suburbs who gets competitive at some point. I doubt it. They think maybe there's an outside shot they can make a Steve Stadelman race competitive, though the Republican candidate in that race has been non-existent at this point. So the Republican campaign operations on both the House and Senate side, the House specifically, are in real trouble as we pace toward November.
I've only got a minute left, but you said something about Congress.
Eric Sorensen is easily one of the most at-risk Democrats in all of the Midwest. He is far more progressive than that district warrants. Republicans have on paper a good candidate in Joe McGraw, but he is not running a particularly good campaign. So the question is, will Republicans invest in that race and can McGraw start to act like a real candidate and make that race competitive? They've got time, you know, it's June, but boy, they've got a lot of work to do if they can make it a race.
That's going to have to be the last comment. We've run out of time. Unfortunately, I had several more topics, but we'll just have to get back to those some other time. I really Anytime. Appreciate you taking the time. Patrick Finkston's been my guest today. He is the writer, the grand poobah of the Illinois political newsletter. Look it up. I think you'll like it if you want some independent, objective news, which we all need. Again, it's Illinoise. Patrick, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks, Robin.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.